Today's episode is a magnificent start of a series. It's on this book, The Hidden Spring by Mark Soames, The Journey to the Source of Consciousness, and we'll bring you multiple parts to bring you through that. It's an incredible book and really mind-opening, mind-expanding, as is the goal of the show. Our guest is one of the boldest thinkers in neuroscience. He's a pioneer of dreaming, a heretic of consciousness, the man who discovered the brain mechanism for dreaming. It is a pleasure to welcome the author of this magnificent book, The Hidden Spring, A Journey to the Source of Consciousness, Mark Soames. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Aidan. Glad to be here.
It's great to have such an innovator in his field on the show, Mark. I'm absolutely fascinated by the book, and I'm very grateful for your time because you've committed a few hours to us over a few days to really, from my perspective, so let the knowledge seep in because there's so much, as I said, a lifetime's worth of work in this book. But I thought we'd start with where it started for you, because as a child, a peculiar question occurred to you. You thought, how do we picture the world as it existed before consciousness evolved? I thought that would be a wonderful way to set it up for our audience.
I think we underestimate children. The questions that they ponder are profound ones. And, you know, as we enter the world and understand the world, these questions arise. And because we are children, they arise in an entirely fresh fashion. You know, you haven't yet learned what questions you're supposed to be asking, and still less do you know what the answers are that you're supposed to give to those questions. So I, like many other children, I'm sure, you know, thought about these sorts of things and tried to understand what the difference was between the world as we perceive it and the world itself. You know, it made a kind of obvious sense to me that I'm perceiving the world through my eyes. And so my consciousness is how my eyes and brain, I don't even know if I thought about it in terms of the brain, but I realized that my picture of the world is mine. You know, it's something, my consciousness belongs to me. And I am not inside of anybody else's consciousness. So, you know, presumably they have their own version of what I'm perceiving. But this one that I'm perceiving must be different from the actual world itself. And then, you know, I went backwards from that to try to imagine. At that stage, I didn't think that simpler creatures were conscious. I just assumed only we human beings were conscious. Not that I really thought about that, but I assumed there must be a time before there were human beings and therefore before there was consciousness. And then I was trying to picture what would that world look like? And it was a real conundrum, obviously, because it's an impossible task. How can you picture a world before picturing things was possible? And I had a kind of the conclusion that I came to was something like this, that the world itself must be made up of numbers or some sort of abstract system of computations or forces and energies. I pictured that as being in black and white, and I imagined my consciousness was a sort of a bubble, and beyond that bubble. So the bubble, the surface of the bubble is the way that I'm representing the world. But beyond that bubble was this sort of black and white, entirely abstract, mathematical, world. And, you know, because it's an impossible task, of course, that itself was not a solution to it. But I remember it vividly. And it obviously was the beginning of the path that led me to writing this book, which, as you say, is the sort of culmination of my life's work in this area.
As the book is, it's part biographical and full of scar tissue of experience working in Soweto in, you know, not so pleasant experiences. but also in more glamorous experiences and showing actually what apartheid was like back at the time when you were studying as well. But these formative experiences had a dramatic effect on you in your childhood. And I'm sorry to hear about what happened to your brother Lee, because that had a major consequence on you as well. That had a major impact and really sent you on this path to understand about the brain as well.
Well, first of all, about the autobiographical aspect, I very deliberately set about writing the book in that style because it flows so naturally from what we've just been talking about, that our consciousness is subjective, and the subjective perspective that I've brought to trying to grapple with these things, first in a childish, amateurish way, and then gradually as I became better educated, you know, in a more rigorous scientific way, it is nevertheless a personal quest, and it's from a particular point of view. So I thought that with this subject matter, it's particularly apt to bring in the experiential subjective aspects of that scientific journey. But now, as regards my brother, we started with this. You and I did this discussion. We started with that image that I think it was in the preface to my book where I mentioned this childhood mystery, pondering, you know, what is the world itself as opposed to our perception of it. I said I think that children do ponder questions like this quite generally, but in my own case, it occurred that those thoughts occurred in the wake of my brother's accident. For those listeners who don't know what we're talking about, my brother clambered onto the roof of a clubhouse, a yachting clubhouse, which was, I think, stupidly designed, this clubhouse, because it had a sloping roof, and it was built on sloping ground, sloping in the other direction, toward the water where the yachts were. So you could climb onto the roof at the back of the building, and then clamber up it, and at the other end, you're facing the water. That is, there's a steep drop down to the paving below. And so my brother climbed up there with a couple of friends of his, and he tripped and fell off the high part and down onto the paving below. And he cracked, smashed his skull and sustained a brain injury, including a cerebral hemorrhage, which, it's just a matter of luck. If a hemorrhage grows too quickly inside of the cranium, it's a life and death situation, because you have to remove it immediately. And obviously, where we were located at a yachting club, there's no way that can be done there and then. But worse than that, we lived in a very small village. So even if he could have been taken to the local hospital in time, that hospital wouldn't have had the expertise. He had to be flown to Cape Town, which is where I live now. And so it's just a matter of good luck that the hemorrhage didn't continue to expand. And so he was saved. They managed the thing conservatively. There was no need to drain the hemorrhage because it wasn't continuing to expand. And they just stabilized him. He regained consciousness. Once he got to Cape Town a few days later, he regained consciousness. And the only treatment that they gave him was, if treatment is the word for it, was they plonked a helmet on his head because his skull had been broken and was therefore vulnerable, and then sent him back home. And so I had the deeply disturbing, uncanny experience of my brother returning looking exactly the same, apart from this silly helmet. But he was not the same person. I mean, literally, not the same person. He was my older brother. I didn't mention that. He was 2 years older than me. I was four. I was four going on five. One of the first sort of disturbing and distressing things that I realized was that he many of his developmental milestones, you know, my bigger brother, that there were developmental milestones that he lost, like, for example, reliable bladder and bowel control. And that just illustrates very crudely the fact that he was now, in a manner of speaking, my little brother. You know, there were things I could do that he couldn't do. And, you know, it's pretty obvious why to us now. But, you know, as a four-year-old kid, it's just completely incomprehensible. How can it be that I've overtaken him? How can it be that he's gone backwards? But more than that, you know, he just wasn't the same person in the sense of his personality. He had a different personality. So, you know, imagine the experience as a little child, you know, just thinking, but who is this guy? You know, he looks like Lee, but he isn't Lee. Where's the other Lee? And how can you become a different person? Again, just to illustrate what sort of thing I'm talking about, we used to play together. The town we lived in was a diamond mining town. In a country neighboring South Africa, which at that time was occupied by South Africa illegally, I might say, and it was a diamond mining town where the diamonds were what are called alluvial. That is to say that you don't have to dig deep holes into the rocks. The diamonds are just lying in the sand in the topsoil. So we used to play. My father was a senior person in that company. And so he took us as kids, you know, to go and see these open cast mines. So my brother and I we had little toy earth moving machines, and, you know, we would mine in our garden. And it was, you know, wonderfully complicated games, you know, where we would be removing the diamonds, trying to create the same sort of scenario as we'd seen with our father. And this I remember very, very distinctly, that I suggested to my brother that let's go and play our mining game. And we went out into the garden, and I realized that the game had changed completely. And for him, the game now just meant let's dig holes. You know, it was just digging holes in the sand, you know, like a toddler would do, playing in a sandpit. And all of the symbolic and imaginative aspects of the game were just lost on him, you know, and so on. That was the sort of thing that happened, and it was explained, you know, that it was explained that he'd injured his brain. So I knew that this had something to do with his brain. I remember also looking at my parents' encyclopedia. We had an Encyclopedia Britannica, it had these. There was one sheet which showed the body, the external anatomy of the body, and then you turned that over, and the next sheet showed the musculature, and then you turned that over, and then the next one, you know, showed the skeleton, and then the next one showed the soft tissues, you know, the internal organs, and I remember looking at the brain in this encyclopedia. And realizing that this part of my brother's body, you know, had been damaged, and somehow that turned him into a different person, and you can well imagine how from there the path leads directly to what I later chose to study, which was not only the brain, but the psychological functions of the brain. So I trained in the field called neuropsychology. It's not that I decided at age five, you know, I'm going to become a neuropsychologist, but it must somehow have led directly down that path In fact, I'll tell you another thing. Since we have so much time, I'll give you the long version. My brother struggled enormously at school in consequence of his injury. In fact, that year of the injury, he failed that year. He had to repeat it. And I should also add as an aside, it was a sort of a taboo subject in my family. We didn't talk openly about what had happened and its consequences. And, you know, it was just this horrible thing. So my brother would always do badly at school and I would do well. And normally you would be, your parents would be pleased, you know, that their child is doing well at school and coming home with good marks. But in my family, it was fraught that fact, you know, that I was doing well wasn't something to be celebrated, and it was something to be sort of hidden. You know, you mustn't draw attention to it. And I gradually began to feel guilty myself, you know, about doing well, and just didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how are you supposed to manage this, because I wanted to do well. You know, I was a keen little student, and I was, you know, enjoying school, or at least enjoying the intellectual aspects of school. So I think that by choosing the field that I did, I think that there was a sort of a compromise. Again, none of this was deliberate and conscious, but when I look back on it, I think that it was my choice of profession was a compromise between, on the one hand, my guilt about my brother, and on the other hand, my ambition, which nevertheless remained. You know, I wanted to do well, I felt bad about doing well. And I think that the idea was the unconscious notion that I think drove me in that direction was that this is one field in which I can do well, because it helps people like my brother, you know. So in this way, I would simultaneously be doing well for myself, but I would also be doing something which was not disregarding my brother's difficulties and possibly even being able to help people like him. So I think that's one of the reasons why I think it's the reason why I also didn't want to just be a scientist. You know, I wanted to be a clinician. I wanted to do clinical work. Right from the beginning, as I entered the field, I knew I wasn't only going to do research. I wanted to work with patients.
It makes sense, Mark, when you read it, when you've read the book and then you hear your story, because my mental model is pulling parts from later in the book back. You know, you talk about early fears, for example, how fears are instilled in childhood, for example, how imagination's almost like a virtual practice in the mind, so you don't have to do it in real life as a child. And then the importance of play, all these things are hopefully we'll have time to cover later on, but they were all part of that story as well. And how, again, you're constantly learning subconsciously, and as you tell us in the book, feelings are there for error correction, there to make us do better, etc. So these are all parts that this is why this story I think is so important to tee us up for later on. But let's start to zoom in a little bit into your theories. And I mentioned that, for example, you are a pioneer in dreaming and also a heretic in consciousness, and we'll talk about in a moment the three departures that you made from common thought at the time, which were breakthroughs eventually, which is what we love on this show as well, is those change makers who actually go against the grain. But I thought I'd share a quote to give context to the book, and I'd love you to expand on this, Mark. You say, many philosophers and scientists believed and still believe that sentience serves no purpose, no physical purpose. Throughout the book, you persuade us of the plausibility of an alternative interpretation. And you suggest that feelings, as I mentioned, are part of nature, that they are not fundamentally different from other natural phenomena, and that they do something within the causal matrix of things. Consciousness, you determine, and you demonstrate is about feeling, and feeling in turn is about how well or badly we are doing in life, almost like a compass to try and figure our way throughout life. And you say consciousness exists to help us do better.
Thank you. So listeners might be puzzled by one aspect of what you've said, which is this, you know, I seem to be using the word, as you quote me there, I seem to be using the word consciousness synonymously with feeling. And I don't think that that's necessarily everybody's starting point. I think that most of us think of consciousness in perceptual terms, because our consciousness is so dominated, particularly by visual perception. So I think when you use the word consciousness, that's the thought, the sort of thing that's conjured up in most people's mind. Oh, this, you know, this thing I'm seeing now is my consciousness, or this thing I'm hearing now is my consciousness, perceptual phenomena. But I don't believe, for all sorts of reasons which we'll have time to unpack in due course, I don't believe that that's the correct starting point. I think that something as complicated as consciousness, if you're going to tackle it scientifically, you need to address its most basic elements first, and then you build up from there to the full complex phenomenology of consciousness. So I won't go into it now, but I'll just say that for reasons that we will have time to unpack, I came to the conclusion that the most fundamental form of consciousness is feeling. And by feeling, I mean things like being hungry, or being in pain, or being sleepy, or feeling too hot. You know, those very, very rudimentary bodily states, which alert you to the fact, you know, that's something's the matter. Something's, you know, you're heading in the wrong direction. If you feel pain, you know, something is injuring you. You must do something about that, which is withdraw from that stimulus. If you're hungry, you know, you need to imbibe some energy supplies. And if you don't, you die. Likewise, thirst, likewise, sleepiness, etc. These things, they're manifestations of bodily needs. Bodily needs are rather important things. And there must be some way in which the owner of the body, you know, registers its needs. And that's what feelings are. I'm deliberately focusing now on the most simple forms of feelings. Of course, I'm aware that they're much more elaborated forms of feelings, namely what we call emotions and moods and so on. But these simple bodily forms, and I'm not just saying this by logical deduction. It turns out that there's very good evidence for this conclusion. But let's just take that as given for now. So if that's what consciousness in its most fundamental version is, its bodily feelings, then, you know, how can anybody in their right mind, if you'll excuse the pun, how can anybody believe that they don't do anything? You know, in fact, if you stop for a moment and reflect on it, everything you do is about feelings. You know, it's the feelings are at the absolute center of your existence. They're what motivate you to do everything that you do, and to avoid what you avoid, and to be attracted to what you're attracted to. You know, all of our decision making, all of our choices, all of our endeavors ultimately are about regulating your feelings and trying to feel better in one or another respect, and trying to avoid feeling bad. So I think the idea, two things I'm emphasizing here. One is that the idea that consciousness and particularly feelings, that they don't have any place in the in the causal matrix of things is just crazy. At the time that I was writing the book, I mean, people say the scientists, even neuroscientists, they say it all the time that consciousness doesn't do anything. It's not part of the physical universe, and has no consequences for it. While I was writing the book, I just read a paper, and therefore I quoted it in the book because it was just the latest version of somebody saying that, in which these colleagues, cognitive neuroscientists, tried to explain the place of consciousness in the universe by saying it's a bit like a rainbow. You know, the rainbow naturally happens out of the interaction between water molecules and light, and then there's this refraction of the light, and it produces the rainbow. But the rainbow doesn't do anything. The rainbow just it's just there. What is the purpose and function or causal power of rainbows? Nothing. That's what they said, and that's how they see consciousness. So, as I am saying, if you just reflect on your own personal experience, it's clear that your feelings have consequences for what you do. So how can you for a moment suggest that it has no causal power, it has no consequences for the physical universe? But the other thing that I'm saying is by linking feeling to bodily states, which you can, in the sense that I've just described, that the most basic forms of feelings are how you come to know your bodily states, your needs, and whether they're being satisfied or not. What could be more physical for us than our bodies? And if you don't have the right amount of water and the right amount of sleep and the right amount of glucose and the right temperature, if you deviate from the very narrow range of temperature that is viable for for us human beings to remain alive, then it has dramatic consequences, physical consequences, namely you die. What could be more physically consequential in biology than that the organism dies? And if feelings are there in order to prevent that from happening, then clearly they're doing something physical. So that's the absolute starting point for me. But I really do need to emphasize that it's not biological deduction alone. It is when you start taking apart the brain mechanisms of consciousness, you find that the most fundamental form of consciousness is indeed feeling, and the parts of the brain that generate feeling are intimately interconnected with the parts of the brain that regulate our bodily states.
I love that chapter. You dedicate a whole chapter to feelings, and I'd love to cover that in depth in part two of this episode of this series, Mark, as well. I was telling you before we came on air, so many aha moments. That's why fears often happen before we're, in our childhood states, and they're so hard to remove because it's before the brain is fully formed, all that kind of stuff. So many great moments. Play, for example, why did play always finish in tears for children? All those kind of things were magnificent to read about. And of course, heavily influenced by your friend and colleague Jack Pransep as well. Do I say his name right there, Mark?
Panksepp, yes.
Panksepp, okay.
Jack Panksepp.
I thought it was important to share your three departures, Mark, as well, because one of the first departures is hidden in the title, The Hidden Spring. It's important as well. So I thought we'd establish that as well, the three departures you made from common thinking at the time. And you've touched on some of them already.
So what those three departures are, the first one, as you say, I've touched on already, it is to depart from the idea that consciousness is fundamentally perceptual, which is the same thing as to say that it's fundamentally cortical, because the part of the brain that generates perceptual consciousness is the cortex. And when I say perceptual consciousness, let us not lose sight of the fact that thinking, cognition, conscious cognition, is also derived from perception. The same images that we perceive here and now, the memory traces of those images are reactivated in our thought processes, and so we have these virtual images, including words. Words too are ultimately derived from perception, from hearing, and so even our inner speech, it's all of it derived from perception. So these perceptual and cognitive functions derived from perception, these phenomena, of course, dominate our consciousness. But for the reasons I said earlier, I thought, well, feeling, what about feeling? This seems to be, the reason that we represent the world, that we have perceptions of the world, memories of the world, engage motorically with the world, is because that's where all our needs get met, So we have to do things in the world in order to meet these bodily needs and the emotional needs that we'll come to. But the part of the brain where feelings are generated is not in the cortex. The part of the brain is much more ancient, much more primitive. And I say ancient in the evolutionary sense of the word, that it's the part of the brain that generates feelings, we share not only with all other mammals, in other words, it's at least 200 million years old, but we share it with all other vertebrates, at least the basic architecture of the parts of the brain that generate feeling states, these things like hunger and thirst and whatnot that I've been talking about. We share with all vertebrates, which means that they're at least 500 and something million years old. I thought that we should focus on that part of the brain and on that form of consciousness. When I say that part of the brain, I'm talking about the upper brain stem. The cortex is like the petals of a flower, and the stamen is the brain stem, the bottom part of it, the narrow part of it. The odd thing is that we've actually known since the 1950s that the upper brain stem, a part of it called the reticular activating system, we've known since the 1950s that all consciousness is contingent upon activation by this reticular activating system, hence its name, reticular activating system. The cortex, which indeed is the seat of perceptual consciousness, it is only rendered conscious by the reticular activating system. So the reticular activating system is the source, the spring, as the title of the book suggests, the source of all consciousness, including this perceptual consciousness, is in the upper brain stem. So, you might wonder, well, why, if that's the case, if we've known that since the 1950s, why didn't we all look there from the beginning, or at least from the 1950s onwards? But that's another story. But we didn't. So that's my departure. I said, I think we should be looking there. Perhaps I'm over elaborating the point, but at the risk of doing so, I will add one further detail just to make sure that listeners get the point, which is that if you damage 2 cubic millimeters of the upper brain stem, a part of the reticular activating system called the periaqueductal gray, if that is damaged to the extent of the size of a match head, 2 cubic millimeters, tiny, tiny little piece of tissue, you go into a coma. That's enough to obliterate all consciousness, just 2 cubic millimeters of damage there. And in the cortex, you can take out 2 cubic millimeters anywhere you like. You won't even notice it. So that's the first departure. It's a shift of emphasis, a shift of focus from perception to affect, perception and cognition to affect, and a shift of focus from the cerebral cortex to the reticular activating system of the brain stem. Now, the second departure I might lose friends and stop influencing people when I tell them this, but well, what can you do? It's the truth. The second departure is that I returned through the history of my field. I went back to its origins and trying to understand, you know, how did it happen that this idea that consciousness doesn't do anything, and what is even worse, when I was a student, which was in the early 1980s, it wasn't only that consciousness doesn't do anything, it was that you must not speak about it. You know, it's bad science. You must exclude subjectivity from science. Science is objective. And so anything that's subjective, you know, must be eradicated. How can you have a science of the mind which excludes subjectivity? I mean, what is the mind if not something subjective? It is fundamentally subjective. So to have a psychology that excludes consciousness or feelings, is to have a psychology that excludes the psyche. I mean, psychology excluding the psyche, somewhere we took a wrong turn. So behaviorism, which you mentioned earlier, was a dominated psychology in the middle of the 20th century, and it still left a long shadow on the neuropsychology that I learned in the early 80s. I became interested in the history of the field. Where did this crazy notion come from that we can't include subjective phenomena in the science of the mind? Went back via behaviorism to the early 20th century and the late 19th century. And in the late 19th century, it turns out that introspection and the study of subjective experience was very much at the center of psychology, which seems natural enough. Obviously, that's what you should be studying if you're studying the mind. And so that brought to my awareness the field of psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis, which was then rubbished by the behaviorists and thoroughly discredited during the course of the 20th century, for all of its faults, it takes as its starting point, if you want to have a science of the mind, then you're wanting to have a science of subjectivity. And it puts subjective experience slap bang at the center of its conception of the mind and of the methods that it uses, psychoanalysis. The method of psychoanalysis called free association, it just takes samples of the stream of consciousness as its raw data. But even more, so that made me interested in psychoanalysis, which, let me just make clear what I'm saying. So that's the other departure, that I'm a neuropsychologist and a neuroscientist, and I started becoming interested in psychoanalysis and eventually actually even trained in it. So I'm also a psychoanalyst. My colleagues were appalled. You know, they said it's like one colleague said to me, it's like an astronomer studying astrology. You know, what are you doing? Why I did it was because I thought that the neuropsychology of the early 1980s that I was learning, it was just really, it might as well have been called neurobehaviorism. You know, there was no psychology there. It was all just about behaviors and about the information processing mechanisms. You know, it was all third person kind of abstract description and questions like, you know, so that's the memory system. That's how it works. That's where it is in the brain. You know, these are its subcomponents and so on. But why do you actually experience a memory. You know, why does remembering feel like something? It's the most remarkable property of the brain, that it feels like something. It's the only thing in the known universe that has subjective experience. Surely the subjective experiences are doing something. And if you leave them out of account, you won't understand how this organ works. But when you ask your professors, as I did, those days, but what about feelings, and why do we actually have conscious memory? Because we learned there are these declarative memory systems, and then there are the non-declarative memory systems, and the declarative ones are the ones that you can bring the information up into the buffer of short-term memory and so on. Nobody ever spoke about, but why does this buffer exist in the sense that the owner of that brain actually experiences the memory? What does the experiencing do? What is that for? When I asked questions like that, I was told, don't ask questions like that. You know, they're bad for your career. These are not proper scientific questions. So, you know, that's why I turned to psychoanalysis as a discipline which had no qualms about studying experience, trying to understand experience, and most importantly, have methods for studying experience, and a conceptual armamentarium, a language, a theoretical language for describing the different aspects of experience and the things that underpin it. But even more interesting than that, as I started delving into that field, remember, this was all part of the going into the history of how we came to this pass that I was at in the 80s, where you weren't allowed to ask about subjectivity. I learned while going into that history that Freud was a neuroscientist. I had no idea Freud was a neuroscientist. Freud was a neuroscientist for a long time. You know, he published his first neuroscientific papers in the late 1870s, and the last ones in 1900. So, you know, that's 22 years and he published, if you count all of his publications, including the little ones, he published more than 200 titles in neuroscience, 200 publications. You know. So he was a very serious neuroscientist. And so I became interested in why did he abandon neuroscience? Because as much as it's an obvious thing that you should be studying experience if you're studying the mind, it's equally obvious that you should be studying the brain if you're studying the mind. So why did he let go? You know, and so I read those early papers tried to get a sense of how his career veered away from neuroscience toward a more or less pure psychology. I realized it was actually not very complicated. It's just they didn't have the methods. These kinds of questions about, you know, how do feelings work, etc. There were no neuroscientific methods whereby you could study them neuroscientifically. So the only empirical science that was possible was using purely psychological methods. And Freud made very clear that this is provisional. You know, one day there'll be progress in neuroscience, and then we'll be able to, you know, supplement our psychological observations with neuroscientific ones, and we'll understand, you know, how the two things work together, you know, how these subjective states relate to the physiological anatomical and chemical things that we know about the brain. So there it was. I thought, well, that's my job. You know, I must pick up where Freud left off and finish the job. And that's the second departure. It's going back to the origins of psychoanalysis and building up the neuroscientific side that Freud had to let go of. And then try to integrate what he had learned about subjectivity, about the feeling, lived life of the mind, link it with what we now have wonderful tools in neuroscience. There's next to nothing about subjective experience that you can't study also from a neuroscientific point of view. So that's the second departure.
Mark, before you go into the third departure, I just, one of the observations I wrote down in my notes was, I wonder, because you speak truth, you're a truth speaker, you call out the emperor's naked. And I thought, I wondered to myself, because you're talking about Freud, and Freud always reminds me of Jung, etc. I was like, because I work part-time, one of my hats that I wear is executive coach, and I always kind of go, I wonder what happened in your early stages that caused that. And I wondered, was it because of that not speaking about Lee at home, that you had this burgeoning desire to be able to speak about it and kind of go, it would be better to call it out. It's annoying me that, you know, I wondered, was that in there? And then the other thing that dawned on me, and many of our audience know this, is there's a great axiom of innovation, that innovation happens at the intersections of different disciplines, of different ideas, of different people from different organizations coming together. And that's where the magic happens. And I really felt that from your work. And then you were also influenced by many change makers like Oliver Sacks, like your friend Eric Kandel, who writes a wonderful recommendation for the book as well. I have one of his books on my bookshelf there displayed, especially because he's one of your friends. And of course, Antonio Damasio, who's due onto the show as well. So these wonderful thinkers were all supporting you as well, I felt.
I'll tell you about that in a second. Let me just say that I agree with you about linking, as you just have, psychoanalysis with speaking the truth. You know, that's that there are things that we don't want to think about, but they're still there, and they have their effects, whether you pay attention to them or not. In fact, if you don't pay attention to them, they have their effects despite you. If you do take them into account, then at least there's a possibility of being able to gain some measure of control over them. So that ethic of speaking about unwelcome things, facing up to them, dealing with them, I think you're quite right to link that aspect of my the path that I took also to the difficult situation in my family, the fact that, you know, I remember thinking, not when I was very little, but thinking somewhere along the line, you know, if we could just talk about Lee, I want to help. I don't want to hurt him. If we can just discuss it, let's come up with a strategy. How are we going to deal with this awkward thing? It was just a taboo subject. You speak then about these other figures and the interface between fields. I completely agree that's where innovation happens. I want to tell you, just in case I'm giving the wrong impression, I didn't decide I want to be the interdisciplinary. You know, this is where innovation happens. I keep on saying this, it's just absolutely obvious that you should be doing this. You know, if you're wanting to understand the mind, you should be studying it, first of all, from a subjective point of view. You need to understand, where does subjectivity come from and where does it fit in to the causal matrix of things? And secondly, you need to use all the neuroscientific tools that you've got. And so there you have interdisciplinarity. It just happens. But when I did start doing that, late 1980s onwards, in the 1990s, I started training. I moved to London to train in psychoanalysis, and then started integrating the two fields from the 1990s onwards. I was like a kid in a toy shop. You know, it was just like you couldn't help but make discoveries, every week, because it was just all so obvious that this links to that and this links to that, and nobody had tried to do it before. So, you're lucky enough to be the first one there. It's just wonderful. So that sense of innovation that you're talking about, arising out of interdisciplinarity, I have lived that. I've experienced it, and it's thrilling to do so. The people you mentioned, Oliver Sacks was the one who came to my aid first. He wrote a book in 1984 called A Leg to Stand On, which was an autobiographical account of a rather serious nerve injury that he sustained, he himself sustained, and it was a kind of a that was the core of the narrative structure of the book, was about his own injury to a nerve in his leg, hence the title "The Leg to Stand On." But then from there he elaborates and speaks about the importance of subjective experience and, you know, why one feels pain and so on, and then at one place in his narrative he makes this remark. He says, "Neuropsychology is admirable, but it ignores the psyche. Neuropsychology is admirable, but it ignores the psyche." And I thought, that's it. You know, this is exactly what I'm experiencing. I'm training in neuropsychology and it ignores the psyche, you know, and this, in other words, the subjective dimension. So I wrote to him and said, you know, that's the truest thing I've heard in the few years that I've been trying to come to grips with neuropsychology. It ignores subjective experience. And he then went on to write a couple of years later, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, which was this glorious set of case studies, all of them being about the experience, the subjective experience of these neurological patients. And so we corresponded through those years, and then eventually established a friendship as I started to travel more and got to know him in the States. And in fact, he also came across the pond quite often. So we spent a lot of time together, and he was a great, great, great. I think that, you know, he was obviously not a serious scientist, Oliver Sacks. He was a storyteller and a writer of case histories and so on. But I think that his work is enormously important for neurology and neuropsychology, precisely because he told the stories of the patients' lives and their experiences of the weird and wonderful things that happen to neurological patients and what they can teach us about what the different parts of the brain that are diseased in them, what they're doing from a subjective point of view, what contribution they make to subjective experience. You know, so this is the importance of Sacks.
Like many change makers, Mark, as you tell us, he was reviled and often disregarded by many of his peers, and it had a dramatic effect on him. I often call that out because it's important to know for change makers in organizations even, that when you go against the grain like you have, you get attacked. The status quo does not like it.
One of his detractors, I told you the name of his book, his most famous book, the Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. One of his detractors said that Oliver Sacks is the man who mistook his patients for a literary career. It's really nasty. I have suffered the consequences of going off the beaten track. But I also don't mind that. I think that you have to accept that's the price you pay. If you're going against the compact majority, you know, they're not going to like it. If you say, hey, no, you're going the wrong way, let's go this way, you know, they're going to resist. So if you don't have people opposing what you're doing, they're just ignoring you. You know, it's you've got no hope of influencing the field if they're ignoring you. If they start arguing with you and saying nasty things about you, then, you know, at least you're being noticed, and then you have an argument on your hands, and, you know, you shouldn't expect otherwise. And then you engage in that argument. Eric Andel, the reason that he became so supportive was that he, in his youth, I never knew this till he told me, he, in his youth, by which I mean at medical school, he wanted to become a psychoanalyst. And his girlfriend at the time was the daughter of a famous psychoanalyst, Ernst Kriss, was the name of this Viennese emigre in New York, as was Kandel, a Viennese emigre of a different generation. And Ernst Christ said to him, "You don't have the right personality to become a psychoanalyst. You should become a research scientist." And that's what prompted Kandel to become a neuroscientist. But he always retained an interest and a great respect for psychoanalysis. I don't know how many people know that. So he was delighted when I started to trying to draw these links between the two fields, trying to integrate the two fields. He said, "You know, that's what he would have loved to have done." You know, if I mean, I'm a generation again younger than him, so he was thrilled to see that somebody was doing what he'd always thought should be done. Once we have the tools to do it. Antonio Damasio, I became his pal because he was a neuropsychologist and a neurologist of great respectability. He'd done very good work particularly on cortical mechanisms of vision, and he was highly regarded trained, in fact, under the great Norman Geschwind, who was the leading figure of behavioral neurology and neuropsychology in America. And I'm telling you all of this about his credentials because in the mid-1990s, which is when I was myself, you know, grappling with all of these things, he brought out a book out of the blue. It was called Descartes' Error, which basically argued that we're missing a trick here. Why are we only focusing on cognition? You know, what about emotion? And it was a brilliant plea with reference to scientific evidence, saying, look, this is very important. The emotions are a very important part of how the brain works, and we're not going to understand it unless we focus on these things too. And because his credentials were so impeccable, you know, he more or less single-handedly brought respectability to the study of feeling in neurology and neuropsychology. So that's why when I read that book, I immediately made contact with him, and we've worked together and established a friendship ever since. But I think we were going to get to the third of my departures.
Sorry, man.
No, it's not your fault.
I'm too interested in rambling. Let's do it.
Yeah. So the third departure, and again, I think that I'm at risk of people losing all confidence in me when I say this, but the third departure arises out of another research collaboration and friendship that I established over the years. This one in more recent years, I only met him in 2012, a very, very, very brilliant neuroscientist in London named Carl Friston. And Friston is quite different from the others that we've just mentioned. He wasn't especially interested in feelings. In fact, he's what is called a computational neuroscientist. He was interested in trying to reduce neurophysiological processes to the underlying computational mechanisms. What algorithms are driving the physiology of the brain? And I don't want to run too far ahead of myself, but he published a famous paper. And when I say famous, I mean Carl Friston is super famous. He's the most widely cited neuroscientist in the world. We measure the influence of a scientist by their H index. And I didn't even know it was possible to have a three-figure H index. I've never heard of anyone whose H index was in the 100. So his is 248 or something like that. And he's truly, objectively, the most influential neuroscientist alive. I read a paper of his in 2009 in one of the journals of the Royal Society. And the paper was called Life as We Know It. And it was about a basic biological mechanism which lies at the heart of all living organisms. It's how they stay alive. It's called homeostasis. I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation about the importance of feelings. I said they tell you, you know, how well or badly you're doing in relation to your bodily needs. Well, how well or badly you're doing in terms of your bodily needs is regulated by homeostasis. If you're in your homeostatic range, that means you're meeting your need. If you're deviating from that range, it means that now there's an increasing demand on your body to do something. And as I said in our conversation earlier, how we become aware of that deviation is we feel it. Unpleasant feelings are how the organism registers it's moving away from its homeostatic bounds, and pleasant feelings are how we know we're heading back towards our homeostatic bounds. And so Briston's paper, the one that I just mentioned, it wasn't 2009, it was 2012. In 2009, he published a paper about the free energy principle. In 2012, he published this one, which is an elaboration of his 2009 paper where he says that the basic mechanism at work in the brain is that we have to minimize something called free energy, which we'll get to in our conversation in due course. But then in this 2012 paper, he links free energy minimization to homeostasis. So this deviation from your homeostatic bounds is increasing free energy. And so I read this paper in which he reduces homeostasis to its basic mathematical formalisms. You know, he reduces it to a set of equations. He wrote a set of equations formalizing how homeostasis works. And that was like a bolt out of the blue to me, because I had come to the view that feelings are basically homeostatic, as I just explained. And now here was a computational neuroscientist reducing homeostasis to a set of equations. And remember our starting point, it was how do you bring feelings into physical science? How can we connect feelings with everything else that we know about the physical universe? And he had just reduced to a set of equations, causal mechanistic equations, the fundamental biological principle of homeostasis. If feelings are an extended version of homeostasis, then it must be possible to write equations like that about how feelings work. It must be possible to bring in this most concrete way. It must be possible to be able to include feelings into a physical, mathematical, causal account, just like anything else in biology. And so I joined up with him, and we had several meetings from 2012 onwards, and we wrote a joint paper in 2018 called "How and Why Consciousness Arises." Where we reduce it to an extended version of homeostasis and therefore an extended version of the equations that he wrote in the 2012 paper. Now I come to my point. There was a famous physicist, Richard Feynman. When he died, it was found written on his blackboard. It wasn't quite his dying words, but it was one of the last things he wrote on his blackboard. He said, "If I can't create it, I don't understand it." It's in that spirit that I made my third departure. I thought, look, if Briston and I really believe that these equations describe precisely the causal mechanism whereby a feeling is generated in the brain, then we should be able to create a feeling. We should be able to instantiate that very same architecture, the same computational architecture, in a artificial agent, and we should be able to engender feelings. We should be able to literally engineer a feeling robot, a robot that is trying to survive has multiple competing needs, like a need for an energy supply and a need to not get damaged when it bangs into things, and the need to stay within its viable temperature range, not overheat, and so on. If that's all that this robot is trying to do, is trying to survive, and it uses this extended form of homeostasis that we're claiming is the mechanism whereby feelings are generated, then there should be artificial feelings in this artificial version of the same thing. If it's got the same mechanism, if that mechanism really is what generates feeling, then it must be possible. There's a gigantic leap that's required here, which is you have to look at this from the robot's point of view. You know, in other words, you have to grant subjectivity to this agent. And then there are all kinds of philosophical and scientific questions, methodological questions about how you go about demonstrating in a way that meets the ordinary requirements of science. But I think that unless we can do that, unless we can actually remember Feynman's comment, if I can't create it, I don't understand it. So what we are trying to do, and have been for about 2 years now, is exactly that. We're trying to engineer a artificial consciousness, and we are not there yet, but we're making bloody good progress. That obviously that's a gigantic departure. The idea that we might actually be able to engineer a simple form of consciousness. And let me emphasize again, it's just simple, raw feeling, and it's an artificial kind of feeling. It's not like yours and mine, but that's what we're trying to engineer.
Beautiful. I'm laughing because my intention was this would be the introduction for the show we were going to do, and we've done an entire show, which just shows you the depth of knowledge that's in this book. It's such a brilliant book, and I'll have to recalibrate, Mark, on what episode 2 and episode 3 will be. Perhaps you might have time to do some more, because there's so much in the book, and you mentioned some of the themes there that we haven't even delved into, but the history is fascinating. You cover it in a fascinating way through the lens of your experience as well, which is really magnificent. And I really look forward to sharing part 2 with our audience. For people who want to find out more about your work, Mark, and find out more about your papers and indeed your books, where can they find you?
My first request is that they should read this book, because, you know, that really... the reason it's a book as opposed to a paper is because the same reason why our conversation today has, we've just scratched the surface and we've spent an hour and a quarter doing it. You know, this is a complicated topic. And if you try to reduce it to a few sentences, you're not going to be able to convey what it's all about. However, having said that, obviously you can't expect everybody to read a whole book. So what I would suggest is that anyone who wants to get a sort of short version, they can just Google my name, Solms, and Hard Problem, which refers to the hard problem of consciousness. So Solms, Hard Problem, and then the word Frontiers. And it'll bring up an open access journal article, which is entitled... The hard problem of consciousness and the free energy principle. But they don't need to remember all of that. Just my Solms, Hard Problem, Frontiers. It'll bring up the article, open access. There it is. And it's a summary of Friston, what Friston and I have done in this field.
Brilliant, Mark. And I'll share that. I'll put that link on the YouTube video and any of our channels as well to make sure that people can find that easily. It's been fascinating. It's been a journey, as the book is, a journey to the source of consciousness. We're only at the very, very start of that journey. We're only actually mapping it out at this point. Author of The Hidden Spring, Mark Solms, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Aidan. Thanks very much. I look forward to part 2.